This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. Today I'm talking to Morgan Entrekin, who's the president and founder of Grove Atlantic Press. How are you?
I'm fine.
And I know Grove and Atlantic are really older companies that have been around for a long time, but you know, I essentially give you credit, I guess, as being the founder. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how Grove Atlantic came to be.
Yes, these companies have a great heritage and history that goes way back before my birth. Atlantic Monthly was founded out of the magazine in 1917, and Grove Press was founded in 1951. But I had been an editor first at Delacorte Press and then at Simon & Schuster in the late 70s and early 80s. And then in 1985, I went out on my own and started Morgan Entrekin Books. And I went into partnership with Atlantic Monthly Press in 1986 and started publishing in 87. I then ended up with a group of investors buying Atlantic Monthly Press in 91 and merged it with Grove Press in 93 to create Grove Atlantic.
And was Grove at that time, it was still in Barney Rossifans?
No, Barney, who the founder of Grove, one of the great figures of the last century of American publishing, he had sold the company in 1986 under a deal that with the English publisher George Weidenfeld and with Ann Getty as an investor, and then he left within about a year after that. So by 93, when we were 92, really was when we started our conversations. Ann Getty was the owner. George Weidenfeld had left. The company was at that time called Grove Weidenfeld, and so that it had morphed a little bit from what it had been under Barney's guidance.
Right. But it got you a tremendous backlist.
Barney, you know, Grove was one of the great countercultural publisher of the 60s, publishing Che Guevara's Bolivian Diaries, the autobiography of Malcolm X, was a great groundbreaker with erotica, like Story of O, and the whole Victorian library, fought the censorship battles to publish Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer and D.H. Lawrence's books and Naked Lunch by William Burroughs. And in addition, had a wonderful list of 20th century drama. Probably we still have the preeminent list of 20th century drama, including Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter, Tom Stoppard, Ionesco, Bertolt Brecht, on and on and on. So.
Yeah, it's a tremendous list. So this sets you up in the early 90s to be, you know, both a contemporary publisher and a kind of keeper of the great tradition of a segment of American literature. So, you know, as it is today, of course, you know, much different than it was in the 90s or 80s or, you know, any time before now. Kind of how do you see the evolution of yourself as a person in the publishing business, but also as your company looks forward to the future? You know, kind of where do you stand?
Sort of on shifting ground right now. It's a bit of a confusing and tumultuous time. I think that it's exciting in some ways, but in other ways, we're facing some challenges to what the traditional model has been. And you know, what Grove Atlantic is not a small press. We're a mid-sized company, and there used to be, when I entered the business in the late 70s, there were 20 or 30 companies like this across the landscape of American publishing. There has been, over the last 30 years, increased concentration. One of the things that makes Grove Atlantic work is the backlist, is that we have this great core backlist. We do more than 50% of our revenue off of our backlist titles, which makes for a very healthy, stable business. What's happening right now with electronic and digital publishing is things are going to change some, and we don't exactly know what's going to happen. We have successfully negotiated to get most of our key backlist titles and authors in business with us with ebooks, which I'm very pleased about. And I think and hope that most authors do that with their paper publishers, because even with the backlist titles, I think it makes more sense for one publisher to be handling both the electronic and the paper book rights. And there's a whole raft of reasons for that, but I think you can concentrate your marketing efforts, and hopefully there's going to soon be a way that you can bundle both the paper and electronic editions together. And if you're dividing up those editions, it's going to really be confusing in the marketplace. So
I think that's an interesting point, and I think that's a fair argument for a publisher to make, that there's a certain value to the that the publisher brings in terms of brand. It's almost called brand management, you know, that you can bring some coherency to the approach that you take to the marketplace because you have all different forms of the book. Of course, that would argue in favor of a kind of integration of publishing that hasn't existed, in some cases, because you've got a hardcover publisher will do an original edition, then someone else will do the paperback. But in a certain way, what you're kind of suggesting here is a redefinition of the relationship between a publisher and an author so that it's closer and more of a partnership. I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth when I say that.
No. I think that that's very true, and I mean that's one of the ways that I've tried to run my business since I, you know, went out on my own, is really tried to be to, you know, I think that also in my 30 years in this business, what had happened was that there developed a sort of adversarial relationship between author and publisher, and there's a whole raft of reasons for that, and the primary relationship for the author really almost became the agent rather than the publisher, and you know, there's justifiable reasons that happened, but I've tried to do it differently, and I've tried to be very transparent in my dealings with my authors. I let them have access to all information all the time about their own books, not about the whole company or the rest of the other authors, but, you know, everybody here is instructed to give any author any information they request about their own book whenever they call. And yeah, I do believe that it ought to be a partnership, and I think going forward, more and more, that's going to, in terms of the added value the publisher brings, they're going to have to be more and more of that role of partner.
I think that makes sense, and you know, because I think everyone in the book business, whether it's an author or a publisher, or a distributor, bookseller, and I guess now even more so readers, are thinking about how this will work as technology becomes more predominant. That the definitions of relationships can change, the way information can flow changes. And you brought that up just now. Thinking about that from an author-publisher relationship, that in a world where digital sales information is available fairly readily, you know, theoretically, I mean, of course, every author in America goes on Amazon every day and looks up their ranking almost obsessively, but you'd assume that, you know, they want to know how many books they've sold every day, and in a digital ecosystem, that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree.
So I guess since we're going to talk about, you know, inevitably talk about digital, what are you doing as a company? What's your sort of strategy at this point for dealing with the ever-changing and kind of still emerging landscape of digital publishing? You've got, you know, it's fairly clear that there's a market for ebooks now with Kindle and Sony and Barnes & Noble's Nook. And, of course, now everyone's talking about the iPad from Apple as another potentially groundbreaking technology. So publishers are now looking at a very different way of addressing the marketplace, because you can't just say, here's a book, it's going to go into a bookstore, we'll market it, we'll do PR, and we'll figure out how to sell it in the stores. But now you have to figure out how do you market and sell to consumers who are buying devices.
Well, yeah, but let's not forget that, you know, I mean, last year the business ebook represented about 3%. I mean, the guess is this year is it's going to be north of 5%. Is it going to hit 8 or 9 or 10%? Who knows? But we're still selling 90% of our books through, you know, bricks and mortar stores or online retailers. So probably, you know, 75 or 80% through bricks and mortar stores. So, I mean, there's a lot of answers to there are several questions in your last question. First, we're making all of our books, all of our e-books available to all of the major e-book retailers, and we're in conversations with any of them that are upcoming and getting ready to go online. But then I think most importantly, what we're focused on is how we can use the internet and the web and electronic media to market the books. And, you know, that's a whole, we could talk for an hour about that alone. I mean, you know, from using the social networks to websites for authors to blogs to, you know, just down on and on and on. And, you know, as I said the other day in a marketing meeting, somebody was saying, well, is this stuff really effective? And I said, probably about 5% of it is effective. But if we also remember to when we just had old media, 10 years, 15 years ago, all the books that we would send out in galley form and all the, you know, finished books we would send out and all the faxes and letters and phone calls and whatever we would make, only about 5% of that was effective also. So in terms of getting through to the media and getting coverage or reaching a bookseller and getting them enthusiastic. And so, you know, I mean, it's just another tool, and it's a little bit confusing and it's a little bit overwhelming. And sometimes I think one of our biggest challenges is to make the right decisions about where we're spending our time and resources. And no one has the answer to that right away or right now. And everybody is learning every day about what works and what doesn't. And it's different for every book. And I mean, that's one of the beauties about, and one of the blessings and curses about, sort of general trade publishing, is that every product you bring out is a new and, you know, distinct product, and you're almost starting from scratch.
That is the challenge for book publishing, I think.
I mean, if you're publishing in genre or like a series of gardening books, or if you're, you know, a person who writes romance novels and just did the same thing, but we don't really publish much that way. We publish more general trade, and a new P.J. O'Rourke book, we have some continuity there, or a new Donna Leon mystery, there's continuity there, but in general, most of our books are unique and new things to try to sell. So, you know, the internet helps us identify markets in a more targeted way. I mean, we have this novel that a first novel that's an amazing story, Matterhorn, a book that actually was brought to my attention through Cecily Hensley and Jill Lamar at Barnes & Noble. It's a first novel from a guy who served in Vietnam in the late 60s and then had a career as a businessman in order to support his family, but has been working on this book for the last 35 years. And we're getting ready to publish it in April. It's an amazing novel. And unlike, you know, generally in fiction, it's a little hard to target a specific market of people. Obviously, you want people who like good novels and good fiction, but not the easiest thing to sort of slice and dice on the net. But with a Vietnam novel, you know, you've got a built-in core readership of people interested in military history, Vietnam vets, you know, et cetera. So we're going to do a lot of marketing with that book in those areas, in addition to the sort of general reach out to anybody who would be interested in good fiction and, you know, going after reviewers and bloggers who would cover good first novels. But it's a constant challenge, and it's a little bit overwhelming these days. It's almost, I said to someone the other day, it's almost, I feel like I already had one job that kept me very busy, and now they've invented another job that I could spend 80 hours a week on if I had the time. So
yeah, I think that probably is a feeling shared by many who are faced with a kind of an emerging world that is layered on top of everything that they already do. Here's another question, I guess, that kind of comes out of that, my interest in technology. Do you see the possibility, or do you see any real openings for the nature of writing and publishing itself to change? You know, it may be experimental, it may not be something that'll happen overnight, but in terms of using the technology to present books in different forms.
Sure. I mean, it's already changing. First of all, there's a giant amount of self-publishing going on. So there's almost a democratization of the process of distribution. Now, that's wonderful in many ways, in that, you know, people can publish their own. I mean, the price of entry is very, very low. Basically, you know, you can type your novel and typeset it through a software program and put it up on the web, and you're published. You know, the problem with that is that it only has increased the noise out there in terms of trying to recognize the worthy material. you know, and if your question, so in terms of how digitization and electronic media and the web and the internet and all those developments have changed publishing, they have profoundly affected it already. And if you look at academic publishing or monograph or technical publishing, you know, it's completely been revolutionized. I have a scientist who I publish named Tim Flannery, and he's a very big voice in the climate change issue.
Yeah, he's the Australian who wrote Weathermakers.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that Tim is in his mid-50s, my age, and, you know, when we were talking about it, when I read that manuscript in 2005, I got very galvanized about this issue and put a lot of effort into helping bring that book out and make sure people read it. Tim was talking to me, and he said, you know, one of the reasons that I came to this issue, he said, back in the 70s when I first came into science, people were talking about potentially a new ice age. They weren't talking about global warming, but he said, because my field, which is, you know, a zoology, paleontology, and he focuses a lot on flora and fauna and the movements and extinctions and endangered species and all over the world. And he said, one of the things that what the web has done is that people, it used to take months and sometimes even years before a lot of the research data was available widely. And he said, now the people are publishing first versions of their data right away so that you could see how climate change was affecting flora and fauna all over the world from many different sources. And so that, in terms of just scientific publishing, has had a profound effect on the way that the discourse is carried on. You know, what you're talking about, I think, might be about, are people going to write differently just for the Internet? Now, you know, I don't know. I was involved in the 80s with conversations with some young computer guys who wanted to contact people like John Irving and Kurt Vonnegut and some of those writers and see if they would write fiction just for the computer, which would allow you to, you know, do alternate endings. And I mean, these were some people that I think they worked in the game, the sort of computer games field. And there has been some writing going on there. And I think particularly in young adult books, there's been some interesting stuff going on there. But, you know, this technology is so new and so young that it's probably going to be the writers who are 10 or 12 and 14 years old right now, who, when they start writing fiction, 10, 15, 20 years from now, they're the ones that are going to have so absorbed the kind of rhythms and syntax and shape of discourse on the Internet that it will be reflected in their fiction.
Oh, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think that actually it sort of relates to something that you said in an interview you did with, I think it was Book TV or something, when you were at the National Book Awards, and they had asked you about something. I can't even remember what it was, but you'd said that, I think it was literacy, and something that I agree with, which is that more people are reading today than ever before, but the nature of reading and the nature of writing is subtly changing, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that that's true.
Maybe what we'll see is, and you brought up the games guys, you know, that narrative is taking place in those games on a daily basis. But they're productions, you know, they're interactive, it's a different form of entertainment, even though it uses narrative. And maybe there will be some merger in a kind of science fiction way between traditional novel and storytelling and game playing and, you know, video creating on the web. I'm not, you know, it's hard for us to know at this point. But
I think it could morph into sort of new forms of media.
Well, you know, although it is sort of interesting how things are circular, Kerouac's On the Road being written on a single, you know, more or less on a single
right.
sheet of paper, kind of lends itself almost ideally to e-publishing, because by definition in an e-book there is no such thing as a page. And he was almost anticipating that, you know, something like 50 years ago.
Well, there's a lot of experimental and avant-garde writing over the last 120 years. I mean, from Joyce and some of his acolytes and Ezra Pound and some of the Dadaists, and, you know, I mean, there's been sort of weird experimental uses and fracturing of narrative and in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the work that was being done by writers like Ronald Sukenik and Walter Abish and some other guys out of Fiction Collective. And, you know, I mean, there's people working on those in those fringes in those areas, and at times they weren't even the fringe. They were kind of fairly mainstream. But now, and the Robert Coover's Hypertext and the stuff out of Brown University in the 80s and 90s, I mean, there's been stuff going on in these areas, and there are some writers who have incorporated some of it. I mean, you look at the work of Dave Eggers or Jonathan Safran Foer, or people who are considered very mainstream novelists today, and their stuff, if it were published in the mid-60s, would have been seen as very experimental, kind of, you know, hypertextual, postmodern stuff, and it now seems very tame. But, you know, likewise, if you look at narrative at network television, you know, some of the jump cuts in 24, that show with Kiefer Sutherland, that would be seen as experimental cinema if you were looking at it in 1967.
Right. Maybe never possible. I've actually thought about this a lot, that the emergence of digital publishing is similar to the state of television in 1950, that people were still learning the technology.
That's an interesting observation. And they're taking this sort of old, I mean, because early television, all they did was just like, you know, use the film or stage and almost just shoot it.
It was vaudeville and theater.
Yeah.
And film that was transferred to a new medium, and it took them 40 years for it to evolve to what you just, you know, to the 24s and the Lost and, you know, other shows of today. And I think, you know, I think you're probably right when you were saying before that it will be younger people who grow up with the technology essentially in their DNA. For them to absorb all of the potential that the medium offers them.
No, I think it's exciting, but I hope we also, I mean, what I now call them is the 100,000 word prose narratives, both in fiction and in nonfiction. I hope we never lose, as a species, the ability to comprehend and engage in those 100,000 word prose narratives, because in nonfiction, I think it's where really the basic ideas of our civilization lie, whether it be in economics or science or history or sociology or aesthetics. You know, if you really want to fully understand a topic, you go and read 100,000 word, 150,000 word narrative on it. And I think that in fiction, the 100,000 word prose narrative does something that no other form can do and no other medium can do. And I don't think it's going to go away. I mean, you see the success of something like Harry Potter in the last decade, and that's going to all to these young kids who are very electronically savvy and plugged in. And, you know, they all over the planet, I mean, people just lost, young people lost themselves in that narrative and discovered the wonderful thing that fiction can do that no other medium can do. So I'm hopeful that we'll stick around for a while.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I think that the transformative and immersive effect of long-form reading, it won't go away. Now, it may not be commercially as viable as it was, you know, at some point in the past, or it may be commercially viable in a different way, but I absolutely agree with you. I think that it's something that it's a reflection of human culture, that it's hard to imagine culture changing so much that story and narrative and the importance of becoming involved in a long story or reading something in depth is going to go away.
Yeah.
So, well, no, listen, it was great talking to you, Morgan. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for taking time, because I know you're busy trying
to
keep up with all of the changes in publishing.
Yeah, trying to figure it out.
On. So this has been David Wilk talking to Morgan Entrekin for Publishing Talks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Take care.
Bye-bye.